peculiar. The wall at one end was entirely covered by an abstract painting made up of yellow, white, blue, and black geometric shapes, which overlapped randomly and seemed suspended atop an ocean of pure blue. But the strangest thing was the large stone in the shape of a rectangular prism sitting right in the center of the room and illuminated by several weak lamps. A closer look revealed that the stone bore rust lines. The abstract painting and the stone were the only furnishings, and apart from them, the room was empty.
Dr. Luo, do you need to change clothes? Kent asked in English.
What's he saying?
Shi Qiang asked, and when Luoji translated, he shook his head firmly.
No, just wear this.
But this is a formal occasion,
Kent struggled out in Chinese.
No,
said Shi Qiang, with another shake of his head.
The hall is only open to national representatives, not the media. It should be fairly secure.
I said no. If I've understood correctly, I'm in charge of his safety now.
Kent relented.
Very well. It's not a big issue.
You really should give him a general explanation,
Shi Qiang said, jerking his head in Luoji's direction.
I'm not authorized to explain anything.
Just say anything,
Shi Qiang said with a laugh. Kent turned toward Luoji, his dignified face suddenly tense, and subconsciously adjusted his tie. Luoji then realized that he had been avoiding looking directly at him. He also noticed that Shi Qiang seemed like a different person. The ever-present smirk was gone, replaced by a solemn expression, and he looked at Kent in a rare posture of attention. Then Luoji knew that everything Shi Qiang had said to him before was correct. He really had no idea of the purpose of the visit. Kent said,
Dr. Luo, all I can tell you is this. You are about to take part in an important meeting, at which there will be an important announcement. And at this meeting, you do not need to do anything.
Then they were silent. The room was completely quiet. Luoji could clearly hear the beating of his heart. This, he realized, was the meditation room. The centerpiece was a 6-ton rock made of the purest raw iron, symbolizing timelessness and strength. It had been a gift from Sweden. But right now, far from wanting to meditate, he tried as hard as possible to think of nothing, convinced of what Shi had said. Any thinking is liable to go off the rails. He counted the shapes in the painting. The door opened, and the head that poked in signaled to Kent, who then returned to Luoji and Shi Qiang.
Time to go in. No one knows Dr. Luo, so there won't be any disruption if he and I go in together.
Shi Qiang nodded, then waved a hand at Luoji with a smile.
I'll wait for you outside.
It warmed his heart. Right then, Shi Qiang was his sole spiritual support. Then he followed Kent out of the meditation room and into the United Nations General Assembly Hall. The hall was full, and the people seated in it buzzed with conversation. He didn't attract attention at first when Kent led him up along the aisle, but heads began to turn once they got close to the front. Depositing him in an aisle seat in the 5th row, Kent went on ahead and sat down in the 2nd row. Luoji looked around him at the place he had seen countless times on television. Based on these glimpses, he had been wholly unable to appreciate the meaning the building's architects wanted to express. Straight ahead of him, the tall yellow wall inset with the UN insignia that served as a backdrop for the podium was tilted forward at an acute angle, like a cliff face that was liable to collapse at any time. The dome, built to resemble a starry sky, was structurally separate from the yellow wall and did nothing to stabilize it, acting instead as an immense weight bearing down from above, adding to the wall's instability and lending the whole environment the overpowering feeling of being ready to tumble down at any moment. Under the present circumstances, however, it seemed as if the 11 architects who had designed the building in the mid-20th century had wonderfully predicted humanity's present predicament. Turning his attention away from the distant wall, he heard two people talking next to him. He couldn't make out their nationality, but they were speaking idiomatic English.
"Do you really believe in the decisive role of the individual in history?"
"Well, I think it's a question that can't be proven or disproven unless we restart time, kill off a few great men, and see how history proceeds. Of course, you can't rule out the possibility that the course of history was determined by the rivers carved out and dammed up by those great figures.
But there is another possibility. Those great figures of yours might be no more than swimmers in history's river. They may have left their names in history because of the world records they set and the praise and renown they won, but they had no effect on river's flow.
Ah, with things the way they are, what's the point of thinking about all that?"
"The problem is that throughout the entire decision-making process, no one thought about issues on this level. The countries are all tangled up in stuff like candidate equality and resource rights."
The hall grew quiet as Secretary General Say walked to the podium. The administration of this Filipino politician had straddled the pre- and post-crisis eras. If the vote had come just a little bit later, she never would have been elected, because a refined Asian lady didn't project the sense of power the world was looking for in the face of the trisolar crisis. Now her small frame seemed tiny and helpless against the sloping cliff wall. As she was ascending the podium, Kent stopped her and whispered something in her ear. She looked down, nodded, and then continued walking. Luoji was certain that the Secretary General had looked in the direction of his seat. On the rostrum, she surveyed the assembly, and then said,
"The 19th meeting of the Planetary Defense Council has arrived at the final item on its agenda, the disclosure of the Wallfacer candidates and the announcement of the start of the Wallfacer project. Before we move on to that agenda item, I believe it is necessary to take a brief look back at the Wallfacer project. At the start of the Trisolar Crisis, the permanent members of the former Security Council held emergency negotiations and conceived the Wallfacer project. The countries took note of the following facts. After the first two Sofons appeared, burgeoning evidence demonstrated that additional Sofons were constantly reaching the solar system and coming to Earth, a process that continues even now. Therefore, as far as the enemy is concerned, the Earth is a completely transparent world. To them, everything is an open book, one they can read at any time. Humanity has no secrets at all. The international community has recently launched a mainstream defense program, which, in both overall strategic thinking and the tiniest of technological and military details, is completely exposed to the enemy's eyes. Every meeting room, every file cabinet, the hard drives and memory of every computer, there is nowhere the Sofons do not see. Every plan, program, and deployment, no matter the size, will be visible to the enemy command 4 light-years away, the moment they take shape on the Earth. Human communication in any form will result in leaks. We should be aware of this one fact. Strategic and tactical tricks do not advance in proportion to technological progress. Precise intelligence has proven that the Trisolarans communicate through direct, open thoughts, making them highly deficient at tricks, camouflage, and deception, and giving human civilization a huge advantage over the enemy. This is one advantage we can't afford to lose. The founders of the Wallfacer project believe that a number of other strategic plans should proceed in parallel to the mainstream defense program, and that these plans should be secret, not transparent to the enemy. A number of proposals were put forward, but ultimately only the Wallfacer project is feasible. One correction to what I just said. Humanity still has secrets in the inner world that each of us possesses. The Sophons can understand human language, and they can read printed texts and information on every kind of computer storage media at ultra-high speeds, but they can't read human thoughts. So long as we do not communicate with the outside world, every individual keeps things secret forever from the Sophons. This is the basis of the Wallfacer Project. At its heart, the project consists of selecting a group of people to formulate and direct strategic plans. They will develop their plans entirely in their own minds, with no communication of any kind with the outside world. The true strategy of these plans, the necessary steps for completion, and the ultimate aims will remain hidden inside the brain. We shall call them the Wallfacers, because that ancient Eastern name for meditators mirrors the unique characteristics of their work. As they direct the execution of their strategic plans, the thoughts and behaviors these Wallfacers present to the outside world will be entirely false, a carefully crafted melange of disguise, misdirection, and deception. The subject of this misdirection and deception will be the entire world, both enemy and ally, until a huge, bewildering maze of illusions is erected to make the enemy lose its judgment and to delay as long as possible the moment it works out our true strategic intent. These Wallfacers will be granted extensive powers that will enable them to mobilize and exploit a portion of Earth's existing military resources. As they carry out their strategic plans, the Wallfacers need not make any explanation for their actions and commands, regardless of how incomprehensible their behavior may be. Monitoring and control of the Wallfacer activity will be undertaken by the UN Planetary Defense Council, the sole institution granted the authority to veto Wallfacer commands under the UN Wallfacer Act. To guarantee the continuity of the Wallfacer project, the Wallfacers will take advantage of hibernation technology to bridge the centuries to the Doomsday Battle. When and under what circumstances they will awaken, and for how long, will be decided by the Wallfacers themselves. Over the next 4 centuries, the UN Wallfacer Act will exist under international law on a level equal to the UN Charter, and will act in concert with the national laws to guarantee the execution of the Wallfacers' strategic plans. The Wallfacers are undertaking the most difficult mission in human history. They will truly be on their own, their souls closed off to the world, to the entire universe. Their only communication partner and sole spiritual support will be themselves. Shouldering this great responsibility, they will pass through the long years alone. So let me speak for all humanity and offer them our deepest respect. Now, on behalf of the United Nations, I will announce the final 4 Wallfacer candidates as chosen by the UN Planetary Defense Council.
Luoji, like the entire assembly, had been listening to the Secretary General's speech with rapt attention, and he held his breath for the announcement of the list of names. He wanted to find out what sort of person would be tasked with this unimaginable mission. His own fate was completely forgotten for the time being, because nothing that could happen to him would amount to more than a speck when measured against this historic moment.
The first Wallfacer, Frederick Tyler.
When the Secretary General uttered his name, Tyler stood up from his seat in the first row and walked with deliberate steps up to the rostrum, where he looked down at the assembly without expression. There was no applause as everyone sat in silence and stared at the first Wallfacer. Tyler's tall, thin body and square-framed glasses were well known across the world. The recently retired U.S. Secretary of Defense, he had exerted a deep influence on his country's national strategy. His ideological focus was expressed in a book titled The Truth of Technology, in which he argued that small countries are the ultimate beneficiaries of technology, and that the unstinting efforts toward technological development on the part of larger countries was in fact paving the way for world dominance by the smaller ones. This was because technological progress rendered the population and resource advantages of larger countries unimportant, but provided small countries with leverage to move the world. One consequence of nuclear technology was that it allowed a country of just a few million people to pose a substantial threat to one with 100 million, something that at one time had been practically impossible. One of his key points was that the advantages of a large country were only truly advantageous in low technology eras and would ultimately be weakened by the swift pace of technological progress, which would meanwhile enhance the strategic weight of small countries. Some might experience a sudden rise, gaining world dominance like Spain and Portugal once did. There was no question that Tyler's thinking provided a theoretic foundation for the United States' global war on terror. But he was not just a strategist. He was also a man of action, and on multiple occasions had won popular acclaim for demonstrating courage and foresight in the face of major threats. Hence, as far as both the depth of his thinking and his leadership were concerned, Tyler made a worthy wallfacer.
The second wallfacer, Manuel Rey Diaz.
When this brown-skinned, stocky South American with a stubborn look in his eyes ascended the rostrum, Luoji was surprised. It was highly unusual for this man to even appear at the UN. But on second thought, it stood to reason. He even wondered why it hadn't already occurred to him. Rey Diaz was the current president of Venezuela, which, under his leadership, had aptly demonstrated Tyler's theory about the rise of small countries. As a successor to Hugo Chavez, he continued his predecessor's Bolivarian revolution. In a contemporary world ruled by capitalism and market economics, he promoted in Venezuela what Chavez called socialism of the 21st century, founded on lessons drawn from the experience of the international socialist movements of the previous century. Surprisingly, he had achieved considerable success, boosting the country's power across the board and, for a time, turning Venezuela into a city on a hill, a symbol of equality, justice, and prosperity for the world. The other countries in South America followed suit, and socialism briefly caught fire on the continent. Rey Diaz inherited not only Chavez's socialist ideology, but his strong anti-Americanism, which reminded the United States that its Latin American backyard could become a second Soviet Union if left unchecked. A rare opportunity presented by an accident and a misunderstanding gave the United States the excuse to launch a full-scale invasion of Venezuela that sought to overthrow the Rey Diaz government along the Iraq model. But with this war, the post-Cold War streak of victories by major Western powers over Third World countries had finally broken. When the U.S. Army entered Venezuela, it discovered that the uniformed military was nowhere to be found. The entire army had been divided by squad into guerrilla teams concealed among the people, and their sole combat objective was killing the enemy's vital forces. Rey Diaz's basic approach to warfare was built atop a single, clear idea. Modern high-tech weapons might be useful against point targets, but for area targets, their performance is no better than conventional weapons, and their cost and limited quantity make them essentially non-factors. He was a genius at low-cost, high-tech exploits. At the turn of the century, an Australian engineer had built a cruise missile for $5,000 with the aim of boosting vigilance against terrorists. But in Rey Diaz's hands, his thousands of guerrilla teams were armed with a total of 200,000 of them, mass-produced for just $3,000 apiece. Although the missiles were made out of parts that were cheap and widely available on the market, they were fully equipped with a radar altimeter and GPS and could hit targets within a 5-kilometer radius at an accuracy of within 5 meters. Their hit rate may have been less than 10% during the war, but they caused enormous destruction to the enemy. Other mass-produced high-tech gadgets, like proximity-fused sniper rifle bullets, had a similarly brilliant track record during the war. During its short time in Venezuela, the U.S. Army suffered casualties that approached Vietnam War levels, and it eventually had to withdraw. The defeat of the strong at the hands of the weak made Ray Diaz a hero for the 21st century.
The Third Wall Facer, Bill Hines.
A debonair Englishman ascended the rostrum, a picture of refinement next to Tyler's coldness and Ray Diaz's stubbornness. He gave the assembly a graceful salute. He, too, was well known to the world, although he lacked the aura of the other two men. Hines's life was split into two entirely distinct stages. As a scientist, he was the only person in history to be nominated for the Nobel Prize in two sciences simultaneously for the same discovery. During research conducted with the neuroscientist Keiko Yamasuki, he discovered that brain activity for thoughts and memories operated on the quantum level rather than on the molecular level as previously believed. This discovery pushed brain mechanisms downward to the microstate of matter, rendering all prior research nothing more than superficial attempts that merely skimmed the surface of neuroscience. This discovery also demonstrated that the animal brain's capacity to process information was several orders of magnitude higher than previously imagined, which lent credence to long-held speculation that the brain had a holographic structure. Hines was nominated for Nobel Prizes in both physics and physiology or medicine for the discovery. Although his work was too radical for him to win either award, Keiko Yamasuki, who by this time was his wife, won the prize in physiology or medicine that year for her application of the theory to the treatment of amnesia and mental illness. In the second stage of his life, he was a politician and served as president of the EU for 2 years. Hines was recognized as a prudent and experienced politician, but his term in office was not marked by many challenges that tested his political skills. The nature of the EU's work at the time, which was largely transactional coordination, meant that his qualifications to face a major crisis stacked up rather poorly compared to the other two men. Still, the choice of Hines evidently took into account both his scientific and political credentials, a perfect combination that was quite rare indeed. Seated in the very last row of the hall, Keiko Yamasuki, the world authority in neuroscience, gazed lovingly down at her husband on the rostrum. The assembly remained silent as all waited for the announcement of the final wall facer. The first three, Tyler, Ray Diaz, and Hines, represented balance and compromise among the political powers of the United States, Europe, and the Third World, so there was considerable interest in the final selection. As he watched Say turn back to the paper in the folder, world-famous names flashed through Luoji's mind. The final wall facer would be one of them. He looked ahead four rows and surveyed the backs of the first row occupants. That's where the first three wall facers had been before they ascended the rostrum. But from behind, he couldn't make out whether any of the people he had in mind were seated there. Still, the fourth wall facer would definitely be there. Say slowly raised her right hand, and he watched as it pointed to a spot not in the first row. She was pointing at him.
The fourth wall facer. Luoji. It's my Hubble!
Shouted Albert Ringier, clapping his palms together. The tears brimming in his eyes reflected the distant blazing ball of fire that rumbled for a few seconds before passing on. He and the cheering crowd of astronomers and physics behind him ought to have been watching the launch from a VIP platform closer in, but a damn NASA official said they lacked proper qualifications for access because the object being sent heavenward did not belong to them. Then the official had turned his back to the group of uniformed, ramrod-straight generals, and, groveling like a dog, had led them past the sentry post to the viewing platform. Ringier and his colleagues were forced to remain at this far-off spot, where, in the previous century, a countdown clock had been built across a lake from the launch site. It was open to the public, but on this late night, there were no other observers apart from scientists. Viewed from this distance, the blast-off looked like a sped-up sunrise. The floodlights did not follow the rocket as it lifted off, leaving its massive body indistinct except for the spurting flames. From its hiding place in the dark of night, the world burst forth into a magnificent light show, and golden waves whipped up on the inky black surface of the lake as if the flames had ignited the water itself. They watched the rocket ascend. When it passed through the clouds, it turned half the sky the kind of red only found in dreams before it disappeared into the Florida sky, the brief dawn once again swallowed up by the night. The Hubble 2 Space Telescope was a second-generation model, its diameter enlarged to 21 meters from its predecessor's 4.27 meters, which enhanced its observational capability by a factor of 50. It used a compound lens technology consisting of lens components manufactured on the ground and assembled in orbit. To put the whole lens into space required 11 launches, and this was the final one. The assembly of Hubble 2 in the vicinity of the International Space Station was nearing completion. In 2 months, it would be able to turn its gaze to the depths of the universe.
"You pack of thieves! You've stolen another thing of beauty!"
Ringier said to the tall man beside him, the only one in the group unaffected by the sight before them. George Fitzroy had seen too many of the launches, and spent the entire process leaning against the countdown clock smoking a cigarette. He had become the military's representative after Hubble 2's requisition, but since he wore civilian clothes most of the time, Ringier didn't know his rank and never called him sir. Calling a thief by his name worked just fine.
"Doctor, in wartime the military has the right to requisition all civilian equipment. Besides, your people didn't grind a single lens component or design a single screw of the Hubble 2. You're just there to enjoy its success, so it's not your place to complain."
Fitzroy yawned, as if it was tiring work dealing with this pack of nerds.
"But without us, it wouldn't have any reason to exist. Civilian equipment, it can see the edge of the universe, but you short-sighted types only want to use it to look at the nearest star."
"Like I've said before, this is wartime. A war to defend all humanity. Even if you've forgotten you're an American, you at least remember you're human, right?"
Ringier groaned and nodded, then shook his head with a sigh.
"But what do you want Hubble 2 to see? You've got to be aware that it won't be able to see the Trisolaran planet."
Fitzroy said with a sigh,
"It's worse than that. The public thinks that it will be able to see the Trisolaran fleet."
"Great," Ringier said.
Though his face was indistinct in the darkness, Fitzroy could sense the schadenfreude in Ringier's expression, which made Fitzroy as uncomfortable as the acrid odor that now wafted over from the launch platform and filled the air.
"Doctor, you ought to know the consequences."
"If the public has placed its hope in Hubble 2, then they probably won't believe the enemy really exists until they have seen the Trisolaran fleet with their own eyes."
"And you find this acceptable?"
"You've explained it to the public, right?"
"Of course we've explained it. We've held 4 press conferences, and I've repeatedly explained that although Hubble 2 is orders of magnitude more powerful than the largest telescopes currently available, there's no way it can detect the Trisolaran fleet. It's too small. Detecting a planet in another star system from our solar system is like detecting a mosquito on a lamp on the east coast from the west coast. but the Trisolaran fleet is only as big as the bacteria on one of that mosquito's legs. How much clearer can I be?
That's pretty clear.
But what else can we do? The public will believe whatever it wants. I've been in this job for a while now, and I haven't seen any major space project that they haven't misinterpreted.
I said long ago that the military has lost all credibility as far as space projects are concerned.
But they're willing to believe you. Don't they call you a second Carl Sagan? You've made a mint off those popular cosmology books of yours. Give us a hand. That's what the military wants, and now I'm formally passing on their request.
Is this a private negotiation of terms?
There aren't any terms. It's your duty as an American, as a citizen of Earth.
Assign me a bit more observational time. I don't need much. Bump me up to 20%, okay?
You're doing quite well at 12.5% right now, and no one can say if those allotments can be guaranteed in the future.
Fitzroy waved a hand in the direction of the launch pad, where the dissipating smoke left by the rocket smeared a dirty patch across the night sky. Illuminated by the launch pad lights, it looked like a milk stain on a pair of jeans. The odor had grown more unpleasant. The rocket's first stage was fueled by liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen, and shouldn't have had that odor, so something nearby had probably been burnt by the stream of flames diverted by the launch pad. Fitzroy said,
I'm telling you, all of this is definitely going to get worse.
Luoji felt the weight of the slanted cliff face pressing down on him, and for a moment he was paralyzed. The hall was totally silent, until a voice behind him said softly,
Dr. Luo, if you please.
He stood up stiffly and walked with mechanical steps to the rostrum. On the short journey, it was like he had returned to a child's sense of helplessness and wanted someone to hold his hand and guide him forward. But no one extended a hand. He ascended the platform and stood next to Hines, then turned to face the assembly, and the hundreds of pairs of eyes focused on him, eyes that represented 6 billion people from more than 200 countries on Earth. As for what went on during the rest of the session, Luoji had absolutely no idea. All he knew was that after standing there for a while, he was led off to a seat in the middle of the first row, alongside the other three wall-facers. In a haze, he had missed the historic moment of the announcement of the launch of the wall-facer project. Some time later, when the session seemed to have ended, and people, including the three wall-facers sitting to Luoji's left, had begun to disperse, a man, perhaps Kent, whispered something into his ear before leaving. Then the hall was empty, except for the Secretary-General, still standing on the rostrum, her petite figure in far-off opposition to his against the sloping cliff.
Dr. Luo, I imagine you have some questions.
Say's gentle feminine voice echoed in the empty hall, like a spirit descending from the heavens.
Has there been some mistake?
Luoji said. His voice, sounding similarly ethereal, didn't feel like his own. From the rostrum, Say gave a laugh that clearly meant, Do you really think that's possible?
Why me? He asked.
You need to find your own answer to that, she said.
I'm just an ordinary man.
In the face of this crisis, we are all ordinary people, but we all have our own responsibilities.
No one solicited my opinion in advance. I was totally in the dark about this.
Say laughed again.
Doesn't your name mean logic in Chinese?
That's right.
Then you should be able to work out that it would have been impossible to solicit the opinions of the people undertaking this mission before it was handed to them.
I refuse, he said firmly, without even thinking over what Say had just said.
you may.
The swiftness of this reply, right on the heels of his refusal, left him at a loss for a moment. After a few seconds of silence, he said, I reject the position of Wallfacer. I reject all the powers granted it, and I will not undertake any responsibility you force upon me.
You may.
The simple, immediate reply to his statement, light as a dragonfly touching on the water, shut down his brain's ability to think, and made his mind a total blank. So, am I free to leave? Was all he could ask.
You may, Dr. Luo. You are free to do anything.
Luoji turned and walked out past the rows of empty seats. The ease with which he was able to discard the Wallfacer identity and its responsibilities did not give him the slightest shred of comfort or release. Filling his mind now was an absurd sense of unreality, as if all of this was part of some postmodern play devoid of all logic. He looked back at the exit and saw Say watching him from the rostrum. She seemed small and helpless against the cliff, but when she saw him looking back, she nodded and smiled at him. He continued onward, past the Foucault pendulum at the entrance that showed the rotation of the earth, and ran into Shi Qiang, Kent, and a group of black-suited security personnel who looked inquiringly at him. In their eyes, he saw a new respect and awe. Even Shi Qiang and Kent, who had always behaved naturally toward him, made no attempt to mask their expressions. Luoji passed through their midst, saying nothing. He walked through the bare lobby, occupied, as on his arrival, only by black-clothed guards. As before, whenever he passed one, they spoke softly into a radio. When he came to the exit, Shi Qiang and Kent stopped him.
It may be dangerous outside. Do you need security?
Shi Qiang asked.
No, I don't. Get out of my way, Luoji said, keeping his eyes straight ahead.
Very well. We can only do as you tell us,
Shi Qiang said as he moved aside. Kent did the same. Luoji went out the door. The cool air hit him in the face. It was still nighttime, but the outside was clearly lit by the bright lamps. The delegates to the special session had driven off, and the few people left in the plaza were tourists or locals. The historic meeting had not yet made the news, so no one recognized him, and his presence did not attract any attention. And so Luoji the Wallfacer walked as if sleepwalking through absurd, fantastic reality. In his trance, he had lost the capacity for rational thought and was unaware of where he came from, much less where he was going. Unwittingly, he walked onto the lawn and came to a statue. When his gaze passed over it, he noticed that it was of a man hammering a sword. Let us beat swords into plowshares. It had been a gift to the UN from the former Soviet Union, but to his mind, the powerful composition formed by the hammer, the bulky man, and the sword being bent beneath him, imbued the work with hints of violence. And then the man with the hammer was smacking Luoji savagely in the chest with a fierce blow that sent him tumbling to the ground and knocked him out before he even hit the grass. But the shock passed quickly, and soon partial consciousness returned, amid pain and dizziness. He had to shut his eyes against the blinding flashlights that were all around him. Then the rings of light receded, and he could make out a circle of faces over him. In the black cloud of haze and agony, he recognized Shi Qiang the moment he heard his voice.
Do you need security protection? We can only do as you tell us.
Luoji nodded weakly. Then everything happened in a flash. He felt himself lifted onto what seemed like a stretcher, and then the stretcher was hoisted up. He was surrounded by a tight clutch of people, as if he was in a narrow pit with walls formed by human bodies. The only thing visible out of the mouth of the pit was the black night sky, and it was only from the motion of the legs of the people surrounding him that he could tell he was being carried. Soon the pit vanished, as did the sky above him, replaced by the lit ceiling panels of an ambulance. He tasted blood in his mouth, and then emptied his stomach in a bout of nausea. Someone beside him caught his vomit, blood and what he had eaten on the plane, in a plastic bag with a practiced hand. After he vomited, someone strapped an oxygen mask to his face. When he could breathe easier, he felt a little better, although his chest still hurt. He felt his clothes getting cut off at the chest, and imagined in a panic that fresh blood was spurting from a wound. But that didn't seem to be right, since no bandaging seemed to be taking place. He was covered in a blanket. Not long after that, the vehicle stopped. He was carried out, and the night sky and the lit ceilings of hospital corridors passed over him, then the ceiling of an emergency room, and then, moving slowly overhead, the glowing red slit of the CT scanner. Faces of doctors and nurses occasionally popped into view and caused him pain with their inspections and manipulation of his chest. Finally, when he could see the ceiling of the ward overhead, everything settled down. "One broken rib and minor internal bleeding. It's not serious. You're not badly injured, but you need rest due to the bleeding," the bespectacled doctor looking down at him said. This time, Luoji didn't refuse sleeping pills, but took them with a nurse's help and quickly fell asleep. Two scenes alternated in his dreams: the rostrum of the UN Assembly Hall looming above him, and the man from Let Us Beat Swords into Plowshares swinging a hammer into him over and over. Later, he came to the quiet patch of snow deep in his heart and entered the simple, exquisite cabin. The Eve of his own creation stood up from the fireplace, her beautiful eyes brimming with tears. Then he woke up and felt tears in his own eyes and a spot of wetness on the pillow. They had dimmed the lights for him, and since she didn't appear while he was awake, he fell back to sleep in the hope of returning to the cabin. But this time, he slept without dreaming. When he woke next, he knew that he had been asleep for a long time. He felt refreshed, and although there was still intermittent pain in his chest, he could believe now that his injuries weren't serious. When he tried to sit up, the blonde nurse didn't stop him, but simply adjusted his pillow for him to lean on. After a while, Shi Qiang came in and sat down by his bed.
"How are you feeling?" "I've been shot 3 times while wearing a bulletproof vest. This shouldn't be anything serious," he said.
"Da Shi, you saved my life,"
Luoji said weakly. Shi Qiang waved a hand.
"This happened because we fell down on the job. We didn't take timely and effective protection measures. We have to do what you say. It's over now, though."
"And the other three?"
Shi Qiang knew immediately who he was referring to.
"They're fine. They weren't as careless as you, walking out alone."
"Does the ETO want to kill us?"
"Probably. The assailant has been detained. It's a good thing we set up a snake eye behind you."
"A what?"
"A precise radar system that can quickly determine the shooter's position from the path of the bullet. The assailant's identity has been confirmed. He's a professional guerrilla in the ETO militia. We never imagined he would dare to attack in a downtown area like this. His actions were practically suicidal."
"I'd like to see him."
"Who? The assailant?"
Luoji nodded.
"Sure, but that's not within the scope of my authority. I'm only in charge of security protection. I'll put in a request."
Having said this, Shi Qiang turned and left. He seemed more careful and cautious now, different from the lackadaisical image he used to project. Ji wasn't used to it. Shi Qiang quickly returned and said,
"You may. Either here or somewhere else. The doctor says walking isn't an issue."
Luoji wanted to tell him that he'd like to change venues. He even started to get up, but then the thought struck him that a sickly appearance better suited his purpose, so he lay back down again.
I'll see him here. They're on their way over, so you'll have to wait for a while. Why don't you have something to eat? It's been a day since you ate on the plane. I'll set it up.
Then he went out again. The assailant was brought in right after Luoji had finished eating. He had a handsome European face, but his most prominent feature was his slight smile, a smile that seemed so plastered on, it never went away. He was not in cuffs, but when he entered, two people who looked like professional escorts sat down on chairs, and two others stood at the doorway. They were wearing badges that identified them as PDC officers. He tried to look as close to death's door as possible, but the assailant saw through him.
Doctor, surely it's not as serious as all that.
He smiled as he said this, a different smile appearing over his permanent one, like an ephemeral oil slick floating on water.
I'm very sorry.
You're sorry for trying to kill me?
Luoji raised his head off the pillow to look at his attacker.
Sorry, I didn't kill you, sir. I thought you wouldn't be wearing a vest to a meeting like this. Never imagined you would be so scrupulous with protecting your life. Otherwise, I'd have used armor-piercing bullets, or simply aimed for your head. Then I would have completed my mission, and you would be freed from yours. This unnatural mission no normal person can shoulder.
I'm already free of it. I submitted my refusal to the Secretary General, rejecting the wall-facer position and all of its rights and responsibilities, and she agreed on behalf of the UN. Of course, you didn't know this when you were trying to kill me. The ETO wasted an assassin.
The smile on the assailant's face grew brighter, like a monitor whose brightness had been turned up.
You're a funny man.
What do you mean? I'm telling you the honest truth. If you don't believe me...
I believe you. But you're still a funny man, the assailant said, the bright smile still on his face.
It was a smile that Luoji noted in passing, but which would soon be imprinted on his consciousness as if by liquid metal, marking him for life. He shook his head and, with a sigh, lay back down on the bed. He did not speak. The assailant said,
Doctor, I don't think we have much time. I presume you did not call me here purely to tell this infantile joke.
I still don't understand what you mean.
If that's the case, then your intelligence does not qualify you to be a wall-facer, Dr. Luoji. You're not as logical as your name suggests. My life really has been wasted, it appears.
The assailant looked at the two people standing on alert behind him and said,
Gentlemen, I think we can leave.
The two cast an inquiring glance at Luoji, who waved a hand at them, and then the assailant was led out. Luoji sat up in bed and thought over the assailant's words. He had the odd feeling that something wasn't right, but he didn't know what it was. He got out of bed and took a couple of steps. No impediments apart from the dull pain in his chest. When he went to the door and looked out, the guards armed with rifles sitting beside it stood up immediately, and one of them spoke into the radio on his shoulder. Luoji saw a bright and clean hallway that was completely empty, except for two more armed guards at the very end. He shut the door, went over to the window, and drew back the curtain. Looking down from this height, he saw that guards armed to the teeth were posted all over the hospital entrance, and two green military vehicles were parked out front. Apart from the occasional white-clothed hospital staffer hurrying in or out, he saw no one else. Looking more carefully, he noticed that on the roof of the building opposite were two people surveying the surroundings through binoculars next to a sniper rifle, and he was instinctively certain that similar snipers were on the roof of his own building. The guards weren't police. They looked like military. He called for Shi Qiang. "The hospital is still under heavy security, correct?" he asked.
"Yes."
"And if I asked you to dismiss all of the security, what would happen?"
"We would do as you asked. But I advise you not to do so. It's dangerous at the moment."
"What department are you with? What are you in charge of?"
"I belong to the Planetary Defense Security Department, and I'm in charge of your safety.
But I'm no longer a wall facer. I'm just an ordinary citizen. So even if my life is in danger, the duty ought to fall to the ordinary police. Why should I still enjoy this degree of protection from planetary defense security, and to have them dismissed or recalled if I so desire? Who gave me that power?"
Shi Qiang's face remained expressionless, like a rubber mask.
"These are the orders we were given."
"Then, where's Kent?"
"Outside. Call him in."
Kent came in shortly after Shi Qiang left. His manner had returned to the gracious demeanor of a UN official.
"Dr. Luo, I wanted to wait to see you until you had recovered."
"What are you doing now?"
"I'm your day-to-day liaison with the Planetary Defense Council."
"But I'm not a wall facer anymore," Luoji shouted. Then he asked, "Has the media announced the wall facer project?"
"To the entire world."
"And my refusing to be a wall facer?"
"It's in there too, of course."
"What did it say?"
"It was quite simple. After the conclusion of the UN special session, Luoji declared his refusal of the wall facer position and mission."
"Then what are you still doing here?"
"I'm in charge of your day-to-day liaisons."
Luoji looked at him blankly. Kent seemed to be wearing the same rubber mask as Shi. He was unreadable.
"If there's nothing else, then I'll be going. Rest well. Call for me at any time," Kent said, and then started to leave.
Just as he stepped through the door, Luoji called for him to stop.
"I want to see the Secretary General."
"The Planetary Defense Council is the specific agency in charge of the direction and execution of the Wallfacer project. The Supreme Leader is the PDC's rotating chair. The UN Secretary General exercises no direct leadership over the PDC."
Luoji thought this over. "I'd still like to see the Secretary General. I ought to have that power."
"Very well. Wait one moment."
Kent left the room, but soon returned and said,
"The Secretary General is waiting for you in her office. Shall we be off then?"
All along the way to the Secretary General's office on the 34th floor of the Secretariat building, Luoji remained under security so tight he was practically shut up in a movable safe. The office was smaller than he had imagined, and simply furnished, with a fair bit of space taken up by a UN flag standing behind the desk. Say came around the desk to welcome him.
"Dr. Luo, I wanted to visit you in the hospital yesterday, but you see..."
She gestured to the pile of papers on the desk, whose only personal touch was a finely crafted bamboo pencil holder.
"Ms. Say, I have come to reiterate the statement I made to you at the close of the meeting," he said.
Say nodded, but said nothing.
"I want to go home. If I am in danger, please notify the New York Police Department and have them be responsible for my safety. I am just an ordinary citizen. I don't need PDC protection."
Say nodded again.
"That certainly can be done, but I advise you to accept your current protection, because it is more specialized and reliable than the NYPD.
"Please answer me honestly. Am I still a wall facer?"
Say returned to her desk. Standing beside the UN flag, she smiled slightly at Luoji.
"What do you think?"
Then she motioned for him to take a seat on the sofa. The slight smile on Say's face was familiar. He had seen the same smile on the face of the young assailant, and in the future, he would see it in the eyes and on the face of everyone he met. The smile would come to be called the Wallfacer smile, and it would be as famous as the smile of the Mona Lisa or the grin of the Cheshire Cat. Say's smile calmed him down at last, the first time he had been truly calm since before she had stood on the rostrum and announced to the world that he was a Wallfacer. He sat slowly down on the sofa, and by the time he got situated, he understood everything. My God! It took just an instant for Luoji to comprehend the true nature of his status as Wallfacer. Like Sei had said, before the mission was handed down, the ones who would undertake it could not have been consulted. And once the Wallfacer mission and identity were granted, they could not be refused or abandoned. This impossibility was not due to any individual's coercion, but because cold logic, as determined by the project's very nature, meant that once someone became a Wallfacer, an invisible and impenetrable screen was immediately thrown up between them and ordinary people that made their every action significant. And that was what the smiles directed at Wallfacers meant. How are we supposed to know whether or not you have already started work? He now understood that the Wallfacers had a mission far weirder than any in history, its logic cold and twisted, yet unyielding as the chains that bound Prometheus. It was an unliftable curse, impossible for the Wallfacers to break under their own strength. No matter how he struggled, the totality of everything would be greeted with the Wallfacer smile and imbued with the significance of the Wallfacer project. How are we supposed to know whether or not you are working? His heart surged with a towering fury such as he had never before experienced. He wanted to shout hysterically, to inquire after Say's mother and the UN's mother, to inquire after the mothers of all the delegates at the special session and on the PDC, to inquire after the mothers of the entire human race, and finally, to inquire after the non-existent mothers of the Tri-Solarans. He wanted to jump up and down and smash things, to sweep aside the documents, globe, and bamboo pencil holder on Say's desk, and then tear the blue flag to shreds. But in the end, he understood where he was and who he was facing, controlled himself, and stood up, only to fall heavily back upon the sofa again. "Why was I chosen?" Luoji began, hands covering his face. "Next to the three of them, I have no qualifications. I have no talent and no experience. I've never seen war, much less led a country. I'm not a successful scientist. I'm just a university professor who muddles through by throwing together crappy papers. I'm someone who lives for today. I don't want kids of my own, and I could care less about the continuation of human civilization. Why was I picked?" By the end of this speech, he had jumped up from the sofa. Say's smile vanished.
"To tell you the truth, Dr. Luo, we're baffled by this too. And that's the reason you have access to the fewest resources out of all the Wallfacers. Choosing you is the greatest gamble in history."
"But there's got to be a reason why I was chosen."
"Yes, but only indirectly. No one knows the real reason. Like I said, you have to find your own answer."
"Then what about the indirect reason?"
"I'm sorry. I'm not authorized to tell you. But I do believe that you'll know when the time is right."
Luoji sensed that they had reached the end of their conversation, so he turned to leave, only realizing when he reached the door that he hadn't said goodbye. He turned around. Like in the assembly hall, Say nodded at him with a smile. Only this time, he knew the meaning behind that smile. She said,
"It's a pleasure to meet you again. But in the future, your work will be conducted within the framework of the PDC, so you will report directly to the PDC rotating chair."
"You don't have any confidence in me, do you?" Luoji asked.
"I said that choosing you was a huge gamble."
"Then you're right."
"Right to have gambled?"
"No. Right to have no confidence in me." Again, with no goodbye, he walked straight out of the office. Relapsing to the state he had been in just after being declared a wallfacer, he walked aimlessly. At the end of the hallway, he entered an elevator and rode it down to the hall on the ground floor, then exited the Secretariat building and came once more to the United Nations Plaza. He was surrounded by security guards the entire way, and though he pushed them impatiently a few times, they stuck to him like magnets and followed him wherever he went. It was daytime now, and Shi Qiang and Kent walked up to him in the sunny square and asked him to either go back inside or enter a vehicle as quickly as possible.
"I'm never going to see the sun again my entire life, am I?" he asked Shi Qiang.
"It's not that. They've cleared the vicinity, so it's relatively safe here. But there are lots of visitors who all recognize you. Crowds are hard to handle, and you probably don't want that either."
Luoji looked around him. At least for now, no one paid any attention to their small group. He headed toward the General Assembly building and entered quickly for a second time. His goal was clear, and he knew where he had to go. Past the empty balcony, he saw the colorful stained glass panel. Turning right, he entered the meditation room, closing the door to keep Shi Qiang, Kent, and the guards outside. When he saw the oblong slab of iron ore for a second time, his first instinct was to dash himself into it head first and put an end to everything. Instead, he lay down on the stone's smooth surface, whose coolness drained off some of the irritation from his mind. With his body, he felt the hardness of the ore, and, weirdly, thought of a problem put forth by his high school physics teacher. How can you make a marble bed as soft as a Simmons mattress? The answer: dig out a depression in the marble the exact size and shape of a human body. Then, when you lie in that depression, the pressure will be evenly distributed, and it would feel incredibly soft. He closed his eyes and imagined that the warmth of his body was melting the iron ore beneath him and forming that kind of depression. Gradually, this calmed him. After a time, he opened his eyes and looked up at the bare ceiling. The meditation room had been designed by Dag Hammarskjöld, second Secretary General of the UN, who believed that the UN ought to have a place for meditation removed from the history-making decisions of the General Assembly Hall. Luoji didn't know whether any head of state or ambassador to the UN had actually meditated here, but surely when Hammarskjöld died in 1961, he never imagined that a wallfacer like himself would be daydreaming here. Luoji felt himself getting snared once again in a logical trap, and once again was convinced that he could not extricate himself. So he turned his attention to the power in his hands. The least of all the wallfacers, Say had said, but he would certainly be able to make use of a terrifying amount of resources. Most importantly, he didn't have to justify his use of them to anyone. In fact, an important part of his mandate was to act in such a way as to keep others guessing, and furthermore, to do as much as possible to engender misunderstandings. Never in human history had there been such a thing. Maybe the absolute monarchs of old had been able to do whatever they wished, but even they ultimately had to account for their actions. "If all I'm left with is this peculiar power,
Why not make use of it? Luoji thought to himself and sat up. After a short time thinking it over, he decided what his next step would be. He got off the hard bed of stone, opened the door, and asked to see the chair of the PDC. The incumbent chair, a Russian named Garanin, was a burly, white-bearded old man. The chair's office was one floor below the Secretary General's. He was sending off a few visitors, half of them in uniform, when Luoji entered.
"Oh, Dr. Luo, I heard you had some minor problems, so I wasn't in a hurry to get in touch with you."
"What are the other three wall-facers doing?"
"They're busy setting up general staff departments, a task I'd advise you to get on with immediately. I'll send some advisors to assist you in the initial stages."
"I don't need a general staff department."
"Oh? If you think it would be better that way. If you do have the need, one can be set up at any time."
"May I have a pen and paper?"
"Of course."
Looking at the paper, Luoji asked, "Mr. Chair, have you ever had a dream?"
"What sort?"
"For instance, have you ever dreamt of living in some perfect place?" Garanin shook his head with a wry smile.
"I just flew in from London yesterday. I've worked the entire trip, and when I arrived, I slept less than 2 hours before I had to rush to work. When today's regular PDC meeting finishes, I'll have to fly overnight to Tokyo. My whole life is rushing around, and I'm at home no more than 3 months out of the year. What's the point of that kind of dream for me?"
"In my dreams, I've got lots of those places. I've chosen the most beautiful." Luoji picked up the pencil and began sketching on the paper. "This isn't colored, so you've got to imagine it. See these snow-capped mountains here? They're steep, like the swords of the gods or the tusks of the earth, and they shine a satiny silver against the blue sky. Utterly dazzling."
"Ah,"
Garanin said, watching with careful attention.
"That's a very cold place."
"Wrong. The land beneath the snow caps must not be cold. It's a subtropical climate. This is important. In front of the mountains there's a broad lake, and the water is even bluer than the sky. As blue as your wife's eyes."
"My wife's eyes are black."
"Well, the lake water is a blue so deep it looks black. That's even better. Surrounding the lake are swaths of forest and grasslands, but remember that there have to be both, not just one of the two. This is the place. Snow peaks, a lake, forests and grasslands. And everything is in its untouched, primeval state. When you see the place, you would imagine that man had never set foot on the earth. Here, on the grass beside the lake, build a house. It doesn't need to be large, but it should be fully equipped for modern living. The style can be either classical or modern, but it should complement its natural surroundings. And the necessary facilities, fountains, a swimming pool, should be provided so that its master can live the comfortable life of the aristocracy."
"And who will its master be?"
"Myself."
"What are you going to do there?"
"Live out my days in peace." Luoji waited for Garanin to say something rude, but the chair simply nodded gravely and said,
"After an audit by the commission, we will carry this out at once."
"You and your commission won't raise any questions about my motivation?" Garanin shrugged.
"The Commission can question the wall-facers in two areas. Use of resources exceeding the set scope, and harm caused to human lives. Apart from these, all questions are in violation of the spirit of the wall-facer project. And truth be told, Tyler, Ray Diaz, and Hines have left me disappointed. Looking at their strategizing over the past 2 days, you can tell immediately what they are up to with their grand strategic plans. You're different from them. Your behavior is baffling.
That's what a wall-facer should be like.
Do you really believe the place I described exists?
Garanine smiled, winked, and made an okay sign.
The world is big enough to have a place like that. Besides, to tell you the truth, I've seen it before.
That's wonderful, truly. And make sure that I can live a comfortable aristocrat's life. This is part of the Wallfacer project.
Garanine nodded gravely. Oh, and one other thing. When you find a suitable place, never tell me where it is.
No, you can't say where it is. Once I know where I am, then the world becomes as narrow as a map. When I don't know, the world feels unlimited.
Garanine nodded again, seemingly pleased this time.
Dr. Luo, you've got another trait that satisfies my notion of being a wall-facer. Your project requires the smallest investment of the four, at least for the time being.
If that's the case, then mine will never have the largest investment.
Then you'll be a blessing to all my successors. Money is a real headache. The specific departments in charge of executing this may consult with you on some details. The house in particular, I think.
Oh, the house, Luoji said. I forgot one very important detail.
Go on.
Luoji imitated Garanine's wink and smile. It needs a fireplace. After his father's funeral, Zhang Beihai went with Wu Yue one more time to the carrier dry dock, where construction on Tong had been suspended entirely. The welding sparks had vanished from the hull, and there were no signs of life anywhere on the giant ship lying in the noonday sun. The overarching impression it gave was one of the passage of time.
It's dead, Zhang Beihai said. Your father was one of the wisest generals among the Navy's top brass. If he were still with us, I might not have gotten so thoroughly stuck,
Wu Yue said.
Zhang Beihai said, Your defeatism is built on a rational basis, or at least it's your own reasoning, so I don't believe there's anyone who can truly cheer you up. I'm not here to apologize, Wu Yue. I know you don't hate me over this. I'd like to thank you, Beihai. You got me out. You can return to the Navy. Working there should suit you quite well.
Wu Yue shook his head slowly.
I've submitted my discharge application. What would I do if I went back? Construction on new destroyers and frigates has stopped, and I no longer have any place in the fleet. Sit in an office in fleet command? Forget it. Besides, I'm not a good soldier at all. A soldier who's only willing to engage in a winnable war is unqualified to be one. Victory or defeat is not for us to see. But you have faith in victory, Beihai. I envy you, really, to the point of jealousy. Faith like yours is the height of happiness for a military man these days. You truly are your father's son.
So do you have any plans?
No. I feel like my life is over.
Wu Yue pointed at Tong in the distance.
Just like that. Over before it even launched.
A low rumble came from the direction of the shipyard, and Tong slowly started to move. To vacate the dock, it had to take to the water ahead of schedule and be towed to another dock for demolition. When Tong's sharp prow split the seawater, Zhang Beihai and Wu Yue sensed a trace of anger in the massive hull. Quickly, it entered the sea, tossing up huge waves that caused the other boats in the port to rock, as if paying tribute. Tong crept slowly forward in the water, quietly enjoying the sea's embrace. In its brief and aborted career, this giant ship had at least met the ocean once.
In the virtual three-body world, it was the dead of night. Apart from scraps of starlight, all was immersed in an inky blackness, so that even the horizon was invisible, and the empty land and sky blended together in the dark.
"Administrator, start up a stable era. Can't you see we're holding a meeting?"
shouted a voice. The administrator's voice seemed to come from the sky itself. "I can't do that. The era is run randomly along the core model, and can't be set externally." Another voice